Welcome to episode 217 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. Today, we're going to be finding out about the ski resort of Saint-Martin-de-Belleville in the Three Valleys, what it's like driving an electric car up the 21 hairpin bends that take you to outdoors. Plus, we're going to look at a brilliant new initiative to raise funds for British Skiers. Now, my name is Ian Martin. I'd like to introduce my guest today. Firstly, I'm delighted to welcome back Vanessa Fisher to the show. Vanessa has been on the show several times before, most recently telling us what it was like taking part in the Inferno downhill race in Murren. I think that was episode 70, around 3 years ago, Vanessa. So welcome back to the show. Have you done the Inferno since then?
Do you know what? I don't think I have, actually. So that was probably 7 or 8 years ago. I'm due a rerun.
You have done it. How many times have you done it?
I did it about 4 years consecutively, kind of after I had my three kids. And before that, I probably did another 4 or 5 times. So not quite the 10, but getting close.
Yeah, well, that makes you definitely a very experienced competitor. And listen, if you don't know about the Inferno, well, I recommend you listen to episode 70. It's an amazing, one of the few, I say, real downhill races that you can do as a non-professional. I was lucky enough to try it as a journalist once, and it was extremely thrilling. Now, I'm also pleased to welcome my second guest today, Simon McIntyre. He is MD at igloo.com. Simon was on the podcast just over a year ago in episode 176. How are you today, Simon?
Yeah, really well. Thanks, Ian. It's great to be back. Thanks for having me, of course.
Excellent. Whereabouts are you today?
I'm in rainy Wimbledon, actually.
Right, rainy. Okay, that is a surprise to me because it feels like it in Britain. I don't know. I've just been away on holiday, came back, and we've got this incredibly hot temperatures here, which is nice when you're in Brighton, been able to go down the coast and been paddleboarding and things like that. But maybe a bit of rain would be welcome. Vanessa, I forgot to ask you, whereabouts are you just now?
I'm based just outside Henley-on-Thames, where I work in my own home office.
Cool. I remember speaking to Graham Bell, who lives, I think, in Henley as well, tells me he goes paddleboarding along the river. Do you get to do that at all?
Oh, yeah. We love going on the river. There's some gorgeous sort of backwaters where you can get away from all the busy boats and rowers. And
excellent. OK, well, to segue slightly off water onto frozen water, a question I always like to ask my guests is, when did you ski or snowboard last? When would that be for you, Vanessa?
So actually, my last ski was in Saint-Martin-de-Belleville, which we're going to talk about shortly. And that was right in the middle of April. So pretty much coming to the end of the season.
Right. OK. And what was it like at the end of the season? I seem to recall conditions were pretty good across most of the Alps.
Oh, it's fantastic. It probably snowed 3 times when we were there. A lot of the time it was actually quite cold, you know, more like midwinter. And then just for the last bit of the trip, we had some beautiful warm sunshine. So really lucky. Fantastic.
Oh, what about yourself, Simon? Where were you last on snow?
Last on snow, we were in Val Thorens on the 28th of April. So the Igloo ski team does an end of season trip.
That's great. Obviously, Val Thorens, one of the latest closing resorts in the Alps. So 28th of April. I'm trying to remember when they close now. Is that around a week before they close, or do they?
Yeah, it was about a week. Yeah, it was about the week after, because it was the Dutch week, just as we were going.
Oh, excellent. Okay, well, we're recording today on the 1st of August. We're still in the middle of summer, but we're slowly creeping towards the autumn. Regular listeners will have heard our features about the London and the Northern ski shows. They're in the last two episodes, 215 and 216. If you would like free tickets to that London show, you can use the code SKIPODCAST, and I'll put a link into show notes for that. We're also right in the middle of the Paris Olympics right now, and in about 18 months' time, Team GB will be taking part in the 2026 Winter Olympics in Milano Cortina. We all know how well our athletes do will depend a lot on their funding. And if you listened to my interview with Dave Riding earlier this year, you'll know a lot about the challenges that British racers face. So with that in mind, I was really interested to hear about a new project called Alpine 100, designed to raise funds for budding racers. And I spoke with Scott Dobson, one of the founders, to find out a little bit more about it. I'm delighted to be joined by Scott Dobson just now. Scott is one of the founders of the Alpine 100 initiative. It's a new project aimed at raising money for grassroots athletes. I wondered, Scott, if you could just tell me what prompted you and your co-founders to start up the project.
Well, you know, I've been involved with skiing and ski racing for an awful long time, and I've always watched people, you know, coming to me as a and say, how can I get the kit, or how can I get grants, etc. And it, you know, skiing is not a cheap sport. We all know that. But it's, you know, and so our way was to sort of find a way that we could help fund these athletes and give them an option to get a grant from the Alpine 100 to go towards their costs. And it wouldn't matter whether it was one of our grassroots guys or an athlete, top athlete.
Okay, so just to get a sense for what Alpine 100 is then, it's a lottery system, a bit different from, well, maybe not so different from the lottery that people might think of with the national lottery. Individuals can pay a subscription on a monthly basis to be part of it.
Yes, it's a per ticket, it's £5 a ticket. And they can buy as many tickets as they like. And end of the month, we then have the draw. And there is the four prizes are drawn. And the prizes are come from 50% of the total revenue has been raised that month.
So if I'm contributing, then you know, the chance I'm actually going to win some money back. But what I do know, and probably the main reason that people will do it, they're not going to do it specifically to try and win the money. They're going to do it because they can see that money is going to go towards grassroots athletes. And so that other 50%, how does that get distributed amongst athletes?
So the other 50%, each month, the athletes can apply for a grant. They or their family have to be in the lottery. So you have to be in to win. They will then send there's an application form on the Alpine100.org site saying what they want the grant for. And we will then look at it and look at on the merit on who needs it and what it is.
And so we talk about grassroots athletes, but it's not specifically, I know it's called Alpine 100, but it's not specifically Alpine skiers. It applies to everyone or anyone who's in winter sports. Is that right?
Yeah. So we want to open it up to Nordic skiers, free ride, freestyle, anyone who might be doing a ski mountaineering race, a ski mole racing, for sure, Alpine, you know, all the disciplines in Alpine skiing. So it doesn't matter which discipline you happen to be in. You could also be a tobogganist, a skeletal racer. You could be in the four-man bob. You could be part of the Paralympic team or whatever. So it's aiming at anybody who's enjoying the mountains in the winter.
Oh, and that sounds great. And the idea being overall, I know you said, you referred to the fact that skiing is not a cheap sport. There's quite a lot of barriers to entry in that respect. So therefore, you've got a budding athlete. They might specifically be looking to, I don't know, upgrade their helmet or upgrade their skis. That's the type of thing that they'd be applying for.
Yeah, they will come to us with their grant application. Part of the grant application is that they must already know what the costings that they're looking for. So they have to go to a dealer or they have to go to an academy or a ski club or whoever they happen to be using and get basically a quote from them, which then is sent in with the grant. We will then be directing the money direct to that supplier. So we know that, you know, if little Johnny comes along and says he wants a pair of ski poles, he's going to be buying them from Joe Bloggs down the road. So and we will then pay Joe Bloggs down the road the grant.
Oh, well, that makes a lot of sense. And so if anyone listening now is interested, what I'll do is I'll put a link into the show notes. But Scott, it's already started, the Alpine 100 scheme, is it? Is it underway?
It's underway. It's been going for 2 months now. We did our first draw last month. It was small. You know, we're hopefully going to be a big oak. So we've got to start from a small seedling. This month, we just literally did it on Sunday afternoon. The first prize was just short of 200 quid. And we're having a meeting this week to decide on the first grant to go out. We've bonded blended 2 months' worth together to make it worthwhile.
Excellent! How exciting! Well, that's really interesting to hear that. And listeners, hopefully from everyone hearing this, will add to that momentum that you've got, and we'll be able to invite you back down the track, and we'll be able to find out how some of those grants have been used. So I'm going to put a link into the show notes. That's brilliant, Scott. Thank you very much for that.
My pleasure. And all I can say is, it's only a cup of coffee, guys.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm pleased to say the Ski Podcast is going to do its own monthly donation to Alpine 100. I think it sounds like a really good project. I'm going to put a link into the show notes so you can do this as well if you want to. Now, I'm going to move on to you, Vanessa. You already mentioned your last skiing was in Saint-Martin. I'm familiar with Saint-Martin. de Belleville, we might find that many listeners to the podcast know Les Trois Vallées, but they perhaps haven't heard of Saint-Martin. Is it the hidden secret of Les Trois Vallées?
Yes, so lots of people refer to it as the hidden village, the secret village. It's on the far side on the Belleville Valley, so it sits below, well, you've got Val Thorens at the top, Les Menuires in the middle, and then Saint-Martin de Belleville at the bottom. I think the height is 1,450 metres, so it's still got good altitude. You can ski right into the village, so it's, you know, easily accessible. And what makes it different from Les Menuires and Val Thorens is that it's mostly chalets, so it has a really lovely kind of old feel because it is over 150 years old. So that's the contrast between Les Menuires and Val Thorens, which obviously are much more modern.
Yeah, well, we'll come on to Les Menuires a little bit later on. And, you know, Simon, you've just been in VT. They are definitively much more modern ski resorts, and some people don't really go for the architecture there. But so Saint-Martin, you're saying it's much more chalets there. What's the sort of accommodation that's available if you're a holiday maker? Is it like literally catered chalets, or is it, are there apartments there?
So there are apartments, and there's apartments right around the snowfront, but way fewer than you would get in some of the bigger purpose-built resorts. And then there's a range of catered chalets and also self-catered chalets. They definitely, when they have new build, they definitely focus more on keeping the traditional stone-built style chalets. So there's certain restrictions to make sure that they keep the village looking characteristic.
Oh, and you mentioned that it's, you know, historic. So that valley is known as the Belleville Valley. I mean, people maybe going to Les Menuires or VT wouldn't be aware of that. But does that mean that that was the original town before those other resorts were built, or the original village, I should probably say?
Well, certainly that was, you know, that village is the village that has the history. I mean, when you walk through it, you can see the old communal ovens where the villagers used to bake the bread, for example. I don't think there was anything else above it. So when they originally came up with the Plan Neige, the development in the 60s and 70s, above Saint-Martin was just nothing.
I've been there. I've never stayed there. I've skied down there before because with my family, been on a couple of holidays to Les Menuires when the kids were younger. And there's a long, long blue that goes all the way down into Saint-Martin itself. And it was a brilliant run to a ski down. And we actually stopped there, lots of little kind of huts along the way, stopped there and have a picnic in the afternoon. The kids really love that spot.
Yeah, so that run is a really well-known run called Jerusalem. And it's often on people's kind of top list of ski runs that they want to do. Absolutely fantastic. As you said, kind of winds all the way down, little humps and bumps that kids love to go over, plenty of little restaurants on the side that you can stop off at, and it literally comes right into the village.
And one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, and I probably should say that you know, you do PR in the UK for Saint-Martin and Les Menuires, so you're I would say an expert on it, right? I noticed I was at a Three Valleys event last month. And they were talking about a new development that's going to happen in Saint-Martin, a new sports centre. And therefore, I wanted to try and find out a little bit more about it. What is the situation then? What is this project?
Yes, so at the moment, Saint-Martin doesn't have a sports centre, whereas the other resorts, Les Menuires, Val Thorens, they do. They have fantastic facilities. So it's been a project sort of long time coming. And the plan is for it to be ready and open for this winter. They haven't set a hard date yet. So whether it's going to be December, January, February, they're saying it will be ready. And there's a plot of land that it's being built on, just on the edge of the village. So it'll be easy to get to. Within the centre itself, the plan is to have swimming pools, sauna, hammam, kind of spa facilities. There will be an outdoor pool, but that will only be open for summer. So that will be the first outdoor pool in the valley, which is really exciting.
Oh, I mean, being in an outdoor pool in summer in the mountains is fantastic. I've swum in the pool in Chamonix before, and there's a beautiful pool over in Latanya as well where you can swim outdoors. But that'll be, I did look it up. Is it going to be a 20-meter pool, that one, the outdoor pool?
Yes. Yeah, that's the plan. So it won't be as big as obviously the one in Chamonix. There's also a fantastic large swimming pool in La Clusa, which, you know, those outdoor pools, as you say, just overlooking the mountains, absolutely gorgeous.
Sure. And the indoor pool, is that like a 25 meter pool, is it?
That's my understanding. Yeah, should be great.
I do quite a few triathlons. I've swum in a lot of swimming pools around the Alps, including up at VT. When I swam in VT, you know, at 2,300 meters, you certainly notice the extra work that you're putting in. But even at 1,450 meters, which is what you said Saint Martin is, right? That's a proper session if you're going to go swimming up there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be great for obviously non-skiers, that it'll give them some extra activities to do in the daytime. You know, anyone that just wants to go for an après-ski swim.
And, you know, a lot of the focus in that valley is on sustainability. In relation to building the new pool, there are going to be some sustainability features as well.
Yeah, so they've gone really into the way the building's heated, the way the pools are heated, using a sort of environmentally sustainable heating facility. That's definitely been a focus for the project.
Oh, and I wonder if I could just segue to Les Menuires. So, you know, there's a like a link between Saint Martin and Les Menuires. I mean, they're different resorts, but they are kind of packaged together, or are they twin resorts?
No, I wouldn't say twin resorts. They work closely together. Obviously, one sits above the other, completely contrasting in styles, in terms of visually, architecturally, very different. They do tend to attract slightly different audiences. People that prefer maybe a more upmarket chalet would probably look to Saint Martin. Many families, people that want self-catering, they would possibly prefer to be up in Les Menuires. But yeah, two fantastic villages that offer that access to the whole of the three valleys.
As I mentioned before, you know, we've been on a family holiday up in Les Menuires a couple of times, actually stayed in the same place twice, which is the CGH apartments there, which are, you know, really, really good quality apartments right next to the slope. And that ski in, ski out side of things is one of the really appealing bits about Les Menuires. You can get up very quickly up to VT or over into the Mirabel side. You referred to the kind of architecture before. Well, I don't know if it is a Marmite type of thing. I mean, there's one particular building there called the Brella apartments, which are, I think, are designed to, you know, be reminiscent of a liner, you know, at sea, a ship liner.
Yeah.
I actually think that is quite a beautiful building, and I think it's probably won, you know, quite a few awards. But a lot of people look at that brutalist concrete architecture and just really find it quite unpleasant, I think.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, in the 80s and 90s, people were vicious about the design, whereas I think now people actually appreciate how forward thinking it was of its time. And actually, that Breland building, I've stayed in it a few times. I mean, what an amazing location, literally ski into the door. It is actually a protected building now. The owners of the apartments are being encouraged to renovate so that they keep it there, and, you know, it remains a sort of an important part of the village.
Hopefully, listener, if you've always considered maybe Les Menuires to be an eyesore, have a look at that Breland building and the resort maybe with a different eye, and you might, you know, appreciate it in a different way. I did notice, I saw a kind of like early release of the Les Menuires info for this winter, and they've made some changes to the Croisette area as well, just to kind of make it a bit kind of warmer and more, what would you call it, user-friendly perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen it since the work's been done, and I think it's ongoing, you know, right through to the start of the season. But it's easy. It's like a kind of purpose-built commercial centre with supermarkets and little restaurants and stores. But you could go in there and get completely lost. And the idea is that they're trying to make it easier to navigate. So, you know, which side you can come out onto the snow front, and obviously which side comes out into apartments and the road.
I'm interested in the branding side of things, and one of the things I read is that they're going to really focus on the branding and get that, because Les Menuires has is it called friendly Menuire is their kind of strap line, isn't it? And they're going to focus on getting that branding across much more.
Yeah, that's right. I think they're going to use the colors, the red of the logo. I mean, it sounds a bit marketing spiel, but hopefully it will just make the village even more attractive kind of thing.
When I've chatted to people from the tourist office before, you know, they're very, I know they did a lot of research with customers to get their feedback, to find out, you know, what they think about the resort, and have worked on all of those things. I'd certainly recommend it. I haven't stayed in Saint Martin. That will have to happen one day down the track. I've certainly stayed in both Val Thorens and Le Menuire. And for me, Le Menuire worked really well. And in fact, I was there one year when they had the yoga festival going on. Yogski, it might be called. Is that still happening?
Yogi Ski, yes. So last winter was the first time that they extended the festival into Saint-Martin de Belleville as well. So it was running across both villages. And then for this winter, the festival's happening again. And again, it will be between the two resorts, so Le Menuire and Saint-Martin. And over the whole week, it's the second week of April, there's all sorts of activities. So you can ski in the day and then join a yoga class in the evening. You can snowshoe up to one of the refuges and have an evening class. It's quite special. And then come down with a torchlit, you know, beautiful walk back into the village. So they're really focusing on the wellness side. So with the new sports centre and obviously with the yoga festival, that side is getting stronger.
You know, I enjoyed it when we were there, but I have to tell you that motivating yourself to go out and do yoga after you've done a day of skiing isn't that straightforward. Anyway, I've got to go and check this out. You know, I might never be in a ski resort where they're doing these yoga things on the top of the mountain. But, you know, I did do it and I did enjoy it. Cool, Vanessa, that's brilliant. Thank you so much for that. I look forward to checking out that sports centre and hopefully having a swim there at some point in the future. I'm going to move on to Simon, if that's okay now. Simon, you were previously with us in episode 176, and you told us about driving in your electric vehicle to Val d'Isère. But I wanted to have you back to help listeners understand that it's not that complicated taking an electric vehicle to the Alps, because I think this year you followed that up by a trip to Alpe d'Huez, right?
Yes, correct. Yeah, that was it. Yeah.
Let's start with some details. What type of car were you driving? What's its official range?
So we, same car as the Val d'Isère trip. It's a Mercedes EQC. Official range is 255 miles, but it's about 230 is what I think.
Is that what you get when driving on the motorway?
Yes. Yeah. That's normally sort of eco driving, about 70-ish, say.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of my experience. I think regular listeners will know that we have a Tesla 3 and the official range is 220. And, it, you know, all depends how you drive it. I mean, the thing is that if you haven't got an electric vehicle, you probably wouldn't understand this, but you never drive 220 miles in one go or 230 miles in one go because you don't. Well, you try not to run it right down to zero. I have run the car down to zero a couple of times before. And kind of assuming that Elon Musk built a little buffer in there, because coming back to our house, I knew I was going to be able to charge when I got back to the house. But it does make you a little nervous when you go down to zero. But typically, for that longer journey, you're probably, well, you can tell us, you may be running it between like 20 and 90% or something like that.
Yeah, that's about it. There's functionality in the car where you punch your end destination in and then the car and the app will plot your stops. So it will take you to high speed charges on your journey. And that takes some of the anxiety out of it. But it's really nicely planned. That always leaves about 20% when you stop.
Yeah. The car, generally, that technology that's built in is so good that it resolves that kind of stuff for you. I mean, when I was driving out the Alps, I've done a couple of times in an electric vehicle. I adjusted it to suit what fitted for me. I didn't want to stop twice for really short stops. I'd rather stop in one occasion for a longer stop and arrange it like that. I'm interested to know, I know you went on a different route when you went to Alpe d'Huez. You would have gone down to Grenoble and across rather than to Albeville when you were going to Val d'Isère. But I was interested to know if you noticed any increase in the number of chargers available on the motorway compared to the previous year.
I think that not drastically, but I did notice it looked like they had added four or five chargers into docks where there were already 10. I think I was really glowing last time we spoke about the infrastructure and a few services. I noticed they were kind of expanding the range of chargers.
When I went, I did it once in a Tesla where I mainly used Tesla superchargers, and once in a different vehicle where I was using Ionity a lot of the time. They seem to be, pretty much every service station.
Yeah, it was a mix of Ionity and there are a few others that escape my mind, the brands, but they're all 350 kilowatt high speed chargers. There was nothing below 100, I'd say. So it was a real mix, but all of them were, yeah, perfect for our car.
Let's have a little talk about Outdoors itself then, because, you know, it's a resort that is perhaps more famous for cycling and the Tour de France. And that is because of those 21 hairpin bends that lead up to the resort. I've cycled up it a couple of times. I once drove up it in a snowstorm in a 2CV at the start of one of my seasons for my pre-season training course with Crystal Holidays. That was pretty stressful, I can tell you. Like, having bought this 2CV, I'd seen a 2CV when I was doing my seasons in Mirabel that I can't remember the name of the company now, but essentially it was a forebearer of kind of a Uber Eats and Deliveroo. They used to deliver curries from Mirabel up to Monterey. One of my listeners will tell me the name of the company. And so on a Friday night before transfer day, I'd get a curry delivered up. And I was so impressed with this 2CV that was going up and down the mountain the whole time. I thought, right, okay, you know, I'm going to get one of those myself. That's about all I could afford as well. And my first experience was driving out to the Alps, you know, driving down the motorways where I was slipstreaming behind these lorries, which made it a lot easier to get down there. But I got to Outdoors and I started to go up the hill and it started to snow and I had these chains that I'd never used before and I was pretty stressed by the time I turned up. I'm imagining it was a bit easier for you driving a Mercedes, but I'm interested to know, you know, when you go uphill, you obviously use a lot more power than you do on the flat. So what was your kind of strategy for, you know, loading the battery before going into resort?
So we stayed overnight on the way out. So we arrived in Outdoors the Sunday, but set off Saturday, drove to Tournus about 10 or 11 hours, charged the car overnight and then left on Sunday morning. There was about 300 Ks from Tournus up to Outdoors. So that we were full, but obviously, the app was telling us to charge again. The app was saying, you know, do 30 minutes of charge. We topped it right up to 100%. I think when I spoke last year, I'd said, whilst the technology is a lot more accurate than I am, I felt it was right just to put some more juice in, considering we were going up. I was really surprised again that when we sort of got to the bottom of the valley, and, you know, the estimated charge that we'd have left at the top by the end of the journey was almost bang on, probably a couple of percent different to what it was telling me at the bottom by the time we got to the top. I mean, the drive up there was fantastic. It wasn't snowing. It was the 7th of April, so the sun was out. It was beautiful. It wasn't very busy. There weren't many cyclists. But it was just a pleasant journey up there. It's so beautiful. It's such a beautiful area. And it was really stress-free. But actually, I think that the whole journey was very stress-free. And we really enjoyed it. Compared to my previous experience, because I knew the infrastructure was fantastic and I could trust the app, this was just such an easy journey. The kids loved it. I was a lot more relaxed about the drive. My wife was as well. And it just seemed to go in a flash. So yeah, that sort of up the hairpins at the end, if you were, just arriving to Outdoors was sort of the, you know, the icing on a cake of a great journey there.
That kind of mirrors my experience of EVs. The first one was relatively stressful. I mean, it was in a Ford Mustang, which I didn't know as well. When I did it again in a Tesla, I kind of, you know, was so used to how that system works, it became easier. But I think the point I wanted to have you back on is to help people understand that, you know, if you happen to have an EV, you know what, you can drive it to the Alps. It's not really that complicated, you know, relative to a diesel or a petrol vehicle. And, you know, listeners will know that, you know, if they've ever looked at Ski Flight Free, the website I've got about alternative ways, it is actually like train travel to the Alps is amazing in that it's 10% of the carbon footprint of flying. But if you go an electric vehicle, because typically the chargers in France, you know, are powered by renewables, and the Eurotunnel, if you happen to go by that rather than a ferry, is also electric through renewables, the footprint of driving an electric vehicle is negligible compared to any other way of travel. So it's the lowest possible carbon way that you can travel to the Alps, and it's definitely possible. One thing I should ask you, though, what about in resort? What were your options for charging once you got to the top? You know, evidently you must have had a bunch of power left.
Yeah, we did. I think we had about maybe I can't remember. We had enough power. We had enough power left in my mind that if no charges worked in resort, and I'll come back to that in a sec, that we'd be able to get down, recharge, regenerative charge down the hairpins, and then find somewhere else to charge when we left. But you know, being open, I found it difficult to find if the charges in resort are working. Because there are charges in outdoors, there are public ones near the Office of Tourism. So I knew they were there, but I wasn't sure if they were working, basically. ZapMap or one of the other apps wouldn't tell me, and they didn't appear on the Mercedes app. But where we stayed had a charger. So we plugged into a, I think it was like a 7-watt charger, you know, on one of the days, and we were there for 7 days. So we left on a full tank, if you were, inverted commas.
Oh, and you mentioned regenerative charging, which... Yes. Even though I can't say it, EV drivers can know what that is. We just want to explain what that is to someone maybe who hasn't used an electric car.
This is my understanding of it, of course. But I mean, effectively, the battery recharges itself once you take your foot off the accelerator and you are freewheeling. So there is almost must be sort of like a dynamo, if you were, against the wheels, which generate electricity and push that back into the battery. I purposely got the stat because we spoke about this last time. When we left, the range of the car, I said, is about 230. But going down Outdoors and those hairpin turns, we got 384 kilometers before we needed to charge, or before the car needed to charge.
Right.
So yeah. We were effectively at 100% of battery for a very long time, and then got to 384Ks where, you know, the app then told me to charge. So I think, again, from a kind of being relaxed about driving, that return journey is made a little bit easier by that, because we only have to stop four times on the way home. We did that in one day. Whereas if we were on flat for most of the way, it would have been maybe one or even a further kind of two stops to that. So it's a nice little feature of electric cars, right? And we get to gloat about it on things like this as well.
Yeah, for sure. It is very satisfying seeing your range go up at the same time as you move forward. It seems quite bizarre. Cool. That is really interesting. And thanks for sharing that with us, Simon. I really appreciate it. While you're on, I actually also wanted to ask you about a recent survey that Igloo did, which I saw. I flicked through it. There's a lot of detail in there, but there are a few things that stood out to me. One of the questions was about what influences people's decisions when they're booking a holiday. And this was very similar to some research that the ski club did, which said that, you know, picking a snowshore resort is the most important factor to anyone booking a holiday. I mean, I guess that makes sense, but do you hear that when you're talking to people over the phones?
Yeah, I think, being honest, last season sort of had its ups and downs with snow and temperatures. So I think that we've probably seen that snow surety that probably creep up in people's decision-making, in their decision-making formula. We also noted that value for money had kind of crept up in that decision-making process as well. I mean, these are very obvious things, but when we survey people, it's really interesting to get that sort of quite deep insight. So I think that probably the last 2 years have influenced some of, naturally influenced the results that we've seen in the survey.
Yeah, another thing I thought was quite interesting was you asked people how they go about organizing their group trip. With WhatsApp coming out, number one as a way of doing it relative to, you know, email, etc. And, you know, I would second that. You know, I am the group organizer for like four or five families that, you know, go from Brighton on holiday. A lot of responsibility as a group organizer. Hence, I'm picking snowshore resorts for that.
Yeah.
But WhatsApp is definitely the way to go about it. Yeah, it's interesting how lots of businesses are starting to engage more via WhatsApp. Another thing that stood out, I was kind of interested, maybe it's skewed by the type of people who are responding, like they're your customers, I think maybe Ellis Brigham customers as well. But it said that the majority of people traveling rent skis, but also the majority own their own boots. As it goes, that's my experience. I have my own boots. And I, you know, always take rental skis. What about yourself, Vanessa?
I do a mixture, actually. If I'm going on a short break, I tend to take my own skis because I find that if you're just going for, say, 3 nights, a couple of days skiing, then to have my own means I can just get out more quickly onto the slopes. But often I do also rent for convenience. Often it's that I don't want to take an extra ski bag if I'm flying, or even if we're in the car with the family, I know, just save a bit of space. So it really depends. I do both.
But you have your own boots, right?
To have my own boots and I have my own skis, but they are quite old.
And just out of interest, Simon, what about yourself? Skis and boots?
So own boots, yeah. Or would always have our own boots. We used to have our own skis, but with, you know, I think the first holiday with two young children definitely put an end to that. I think we came back and sold all our skis on eBay. I think there are a few interesting parts to this. The evolution of the marketplace. So the ski equipment that we see today in those rental shops is way, way superior than it was 20 years ago that, you know, that we'll potentially remember. Also on the other side of that, you know, when I started working at Ingham's 20 years ago, ski carriage with Monarch was 15 quid return. And now we all know that ski carriage is nowhere near that. So there are those kind of factors, as well as lifestyle and you know, sort of demographic that have probably played a part in the reason for those stats as well.
You know, regular listeners will know that Intersport is, or was last winter, the title sponsor of the podcast. So it's no secret that I'm a fan of ski hire, not just for that, but because when I go out, I like the fact that you can change your skis during the week. So if you go out there and, you know, if I'm with family, typically, you know, I'm going to be skiing on piste, but there might be a day during the week where the weather's bad, they don't want to go out, or we want to take a break and I want to go ski touring, and I can just go to the hire shop and swap them and take out touring skis as well. And it saves me having to, you know, well, lug around a quiver of skis with me, which isn't going to work. So anyway, I'm pleased to report Intersport are coming back as our main partner for the winter. So pretty early. I don't know if there are any listeners out there booking their ski hire yet on the 1st of August. But when you do this winter, if you use that code SKIPODCAST, you know, you will get an additional discount when you book. I'll put a link into the show notes for that as well. Well, that is very interesting. We're going to move to close now. I enjoy all feedback about the show. I'd like to know what you think, especially about our features. So please contact me on social at SKIPODCAST or by email, theskipodcast@gmail.com. Johnny Richard sent an email saying, keep up the good work with the episodes. I mentioned in the last episode that you can now leave comments on Spotify. It turned out that listeners have been doing this for months already. I actually discovered a few. One was from @0_cool, who said, as always, amazing interview with Paddy Graham. That was number 211. Thank you, Ian. I learned so much from that episode that I completely missed in the early 2000s, despite being there in it all. So I don't know who Zero Cool is, but maybe a freestyler from the early 2000s. David Lindsay, who's appeared on the podcast before, he said, another great episode, the Paddy Graham one, that was. What a star Paddy is. And Pablo said, good to hear about Scotland. More content about other mountain ranges in Europe, please. Well, the good news is, Pablo, we have a lot of content about mountain ranges in Europe. Have a look at our back catalogue. It's all in there. And I got so many comments I found on Spotify. I'll include some of those in episode 218 as well. Now, if you like the podcast, there are three things you can do to help. You can review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and you can leave comments there as well. Subscribing is a great idea. If you're listening online now, just click that button, because as soon as we move into autumn, there are going to be a lot more episodes, and you can make sure that you don't miss any. And finally, if you want to, you can buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/ski podcast, and I will cash it in for a cup of tea. Now, you can follow me at Skipedia and the podcast at The Ski Podcast. There are now 222 episodes of The Ski Podcast to catch up with. 83 of those were listened to in the last week. So if you are missing the snow in the lead up to the winter, there is so much to listen to in that back catalogue. Just go to theskipodcast.com, search around those tags and categories, and you're bound to find something of interest to you. Now, I noticed in this Olympic week, our audience has become even more international. 51% of our listeners were in the UK, 18% in Australia. I mean, I think maybe they were catching up on episode 215, where we had a focus on Australia, and 12% in the States. That leaves the remaining 19% from across the world, including Argentina, Vietnam, and Saudi Arabia. So all that remains today is to thank my guests. Vanessa, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Simon, thank you.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, bye.